Thank you for choosing to listen to Phoenix Fire today. Phoenix Fire features John Anthony West. You can access the Phoenix Fire blog at www.jawphoenixfire.blogspot.com. You can learn more about John Anthony West by going to www.jawest.net.
Phoenix Fire number 6.
This is Phoenix Fire. John Anthony West, rogue Egyptologist and mystic in skeptics clothing, broadcasting from West Henge in the wilderness with something to offend everyone. Welcome to the conflagration. Welcome back to Phoenix Fire, number 6, Son of Mystery of the Sphinx, part 4, the Book of Boris, chapter 2. We last left you with my sociopath partner, Boris Said, having fallen off the toilet seat, an act that shattered a whole rack of ribs, and that ultimately resulted in Boris winning a lawsuit worth $300,000. $100,000 went to the lawyer and $200,000 to Boris himself. Meanwhile, back at Rancho Quackademia, the controversy, the scholarly controversy, raged on, set into motion, this time by our NBC prize-winning, Emmy Award-winning special, hosted by Charlton Heston, Mystery of the Sphinx. And we will return to the ongoing story shortly. But first, I'd like to tell you about a particularly interesting and valuable seminar coming up in October. It is called CPAC, C-P-A-K, which stands for the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge. This is the third CPAC conference. The first two featured a spectrum of very interesting speakers, yours truly included, and this year's CPAC 2007 will take place in San Diego, California, again with a stellar collection of extraordinary speakers. This is not your ordinary conference on UFOs or whatever, not that there's anything wrong with those, but this is a conference of another order. And last time it was well attended, more than 300 people there. A whole bunch of those 300 people will be back. If you're interested in following through, here's the URL. It is binary, B-I-N-A-R-Y, research, R-E-S-E-A-R-C-H, institute.org. You pull that up and the homepage comes up and you'll see on the homepage CPAC 2007. From there on, it's up to you. I speak at conferences all over the place all the time. This was one of the very few where I actually made a point of listening to what all the other guys had to say. Sometimes I don't. This time it was worth it, and as I say, highly recommended. Those of you who, in fact, sign on, you might let me know. I'd like to know who comes through Phoenix Fire and my website and so on. So pull it up when you're ready, and now back we go to Son of Mystery of the Sphinx, Book of Boris, Chapter 2.
Phoenix Fire!
Now, as I said in the former, in the last episode, there are a number of, not so much lanes to this long story of Mystery of the of Son of Mystery of the Sphinx, but rather like a spider web, there are tracks that go parallel and that don't necessarily meet each other. So here we'll leave our Boris track, and we'll leave Boris to his temper, his pathological lies, his shenanigans, his charisma, unbelievable energy, and we'll skip over to our controversy thread. Now, with Mystery of the Sphinx winning, it'll take a year before it won its Emmy, but with it getting its the enormous ratings that it got, now the quackademic establishment felt obliged to address it in something like seriousness. Before, even after the GSA meeting and the AAAS meeting, the debate there, lots of press, particularly in newspapers, but now the heavy hitters got into the fray. This was Archaeology magazine, where Zahi Hawass and Mark Lehner weighed in. After a few years, the New Yorker itself, the Egyptology magazine meant for the lay reader, KMT, Kemet, the name for ancient Egypt, French Observateur, lots and lots of other magazines. And for the most part, these were hatchet jobs. And I, for one, really never mind a hatchet job, as long as there is the possibility of redress, of response. And unfortunately, with the magazines, in fact, even with the newspapers, usually there isn't. They get the opposition, gets the establishment, gets as many thousand words as they need to refute the theory. We, if we're lucky, get a couple of hundred, and it's a complicated issue, so a couple of hundred doesn't really do the trick. Even though I do not have the respect that I'm supposed to have for the Egyptological or the archaeological establishment, I really do understand their position. We're upsetting the apple cart, and they make a living selling apples. They have a lot at stake. The journalists actually, at least in theory, don't have anything at stake. They're supposed to be journalists. They're supposed to look into both sides of the story. And as a general rule, they don't. So there are a couple of these guys that I must say I have in due course, when we get our geo panel together and the geologists hammer it out, both pro and con, and if the results come out the way that I hope they're going to come out, there are a couple of these people that I will write them again in due course and let them know that by the time I'm finished, they'll have eaten so much crow it'll be an endangered species. In particular, guy in the New Yorker I have it really in for, named Alexander Stille, S-T-I-L-L-E. That story was in, I forget when it was, 97, 98, something like that. The New Yorker is not what it used to be, even though it likes to think that it is, and that issue has long since disappeared from the waiting rooms of the few thousand geriatric dentists who still subscribe to the magazine. Probably Stille and myself and Robert Schock are the only ones who remember it, but I will remind him of it in due course. And mainly what I've got against him, I don't mind what he says, but he wrote the article, and as a New Yorker, you get paid a lot for New Yorker articles. You can afford to do your research. There's plenty of time for that. So he took Zahi Hawass and Mark Lehner accounts at face value and never actually even bothered to call Robert Schock or myself. That is irresponsible, to say the least. It's phony journalism, and I hope I get the opportunity to take him to task for that. There's actually no excuse for journalists to, there's really no excuse for journalists not to look at both sides of the story, particularly one like this, which is really independent of, let's say, political persuasions or whatever. But when you get down, when you get to the bottom of it, and you look at what journalism is, it's a kind of slow motion bobsled in its own right. You don't unbalance the ride. This is something that probably most people in this audience or the general audience don't really understand what a con job most so-called news is. You only get a sense of that once you're a piece of it, even in at the edges. For example, years and years ago when I was in Ibiza and it was the great hippie haven of the Western world, journalists who knew nothing about Ibiza, who had no artistic talent or creativity of their own, came to write about the real Ibiza and to report back. Well, these things were jokes. They were all over the place. New York Times, Playboy magazine, all sorts of articles. And they were a joke. We on the island used to read these things and realize that these people hadn't a clue. They'd interview a couple of hippies, get laid somewhere, drop a tab of acid and think they knew Ibiza. And of course they didn't. Well, the same thing applies up and down the line. And once you've been subjected to that sort of stuff, actually what you do is you develop a very healthy disrespect, or at least an attitude of considerable circumspection to virtually anything that you read in a newspaper or a magazine, because it's basically, for the most part, it's Church of Progress oriented, and the journalists have their own agenda, even though they say they don't, and they're out to do an objective analysis or an objective report, and it's very, very, very rare that it is that way. So we know this from bitter experience. And in this case, to go back to a theme that I've discussed a number of times on the first five shows, what's at stake here? Because this, it's worth, let's say, it's worth harping on this subject, even if it's ad nauseum, because what's at stake is not simply a quibble between academics or even a major scientific breakthrough. It is that, but, and I'm talking now specifically about the water weathering to the Sphinx, but also by extension, the symbolist view of Egypt, which is inescapably entwined with the mystery of the Sphinx, with the geology of the Sphinx itself. And what's at stake is exactly, precisely, our view of history. And that is, to understand why that is so important, it's a matter of, really, it's back to our Church of Progress, to the central dogma of what calls itself scientific rationalism, but what is, in fact, a bogus religion in its own right. And the central dogma is, of course, that we human beings, we inventors of the bobblehead doll and the weapons of mass destruction and the biochemical and biological warfare, we are the greatest, we are the most evolved human beings that have ever existed on this planet. And the mystery of the Sphinx, or rather the geology of the Sphinx, actually sits there thumbing its nose at that central dogma. So the journalists involved, as well as the academics directly involved, the journalists are not directly involved or directly affected, but they are actually tangentially affected. Most of them, if they were not to some extent or another believers in the Church of Progress, if not the high priests, are nevertheless loyal devotees. And anything that promises to shake up that dogma or to destroy it must be counteracted, and if humanly possible, either quibbled into silence or shouted into silence, one or the other. So this is what we're up against, and this is what we've been up against since that first GSA meeting back in 1991, and so the battle rages on. Now, when we're talking about upsetting a major paradigm, upsetting a dogma, and if I could digress here and go on to another, let's say, another thread of the spider's web, there are certain teaching tales, let's say, if you're interested in these things at all. In other words, if you're interested in, I almost hate to use these words because they're so overused, but let's say self-development. If you realize to begin with that maybe things aren't as great as we're led to believe, that progress is not what it's cracked up to be, well, we have to take a certain kind of inner responsibility for our own lives. And it's a big battle for everyone personally, but for those of us who are actually, let's say, actively trying to upset the apple cart and bust the paradigm, for us, there are certain teaching tales, let's say, things that we use personally, and we'll all be a bit different. Let's say my own colleagues, Robert Schock, who works directly with me, some of my friends, Graham Hancock, Robert Boval, Richard Heath, John Michel, many, many names, some of which you may be familiar with, some not. But if you're not, somewhere along the line, I'll be talking about them and talking about their work. We all have our own, let's say, favorite tales. And I've even thought, when I was recently in Brazil, had an extraordinary seminar down on an island called Florianopolis. More on that somewhere along the line. Actually, for those who want to know what was going on at that seminar, you might get hold of Graham Hancock's new book, Supernatural, which is a typical Graham book, 600 pages of carefully, minutely organized material based upon the use by shamanic societies of particular, let's say, hallucinogenic or psychotropic drugs. In this case, we're talking about ayahuasca, the famous ayahuasca. More on that somewhere along the line. But anyway, back to the teaching tales. There are a few that struck me, and I even had the idea at the seminar that it would be a very interesting psychological test. There are all sorts of psychological tests, but I'm not a psychologist. But I haven't heard one like this, which is to have people just list or tell their own favorite teaching tales, the tale that actually you can, in a way, you can live your whole life by. You hold it in front of you. You use it as a screensaver. A line or so. My screensaver actually comes from Gurdjieff, and it's two words: use everything. Think about it a minute. Use everything. If you're at a sufficient level of development, then I'm not, but if you are at a sufficient level of development, you can use being burnt at the stake to your own advantage. This is rather difficult. Just putting up with nonstop abuse is difficult enough, but there are certain teaching tales, and if you write them down, actually, you'd have a very interesting psychological profile. Try it. I haven't tried it out on anybody yet, but I have my own. So here's one. My friend Satish Kumar, Indian, and who runs the little environmental ecological magazine called Resurgence, told me when I lived in Wales and I was doing some writing for Resurgence, we were talking about something or another, and I was going on at my usual onslaught on the Church of Progress, and he said that his guru, when he was living back in India, had studied with Gandhi or with one of Gandhi's more prominent disciples, and he had the line, I don't know if it's original to him, but better to light one candle than curse the darkness. And I always liked that one, although I had my own caveats about it. Lighting one candle doesn't necessarily do much. That it doesn't dispel the darkness, not really, though it may call attention to the darkness. That's beneficial. And quite possibly, at least the tack I like to take, is that eloquent cursing maybe gets lots more people to light candles. I don't know. Now, it's useful sometimes to be able to take in both points of view, the teaching tales. For example, we're all of us now, bombarded with the whole subject of global warming, whether or not it's man-made, whether or not it's natural. To a certain extent, as far as I'm concerned, it's sort of beside the point. In a world with 6 billion people in it, virtually anything that's done amounts to little more than environmental band-aids and ecological aspirins. The situation looks practically hopeless. But there is, in fact, a teaching tale, one that just came across my computer a few days ago, that takes another point of view on that subject, and it is that we will return to when we come back from these important messages.
Phoenix Fire.
Surprise! Until we find sponsors for our dedicated ad space, it's still John Anthony West, here to tell you about my personally guided magical Egypt tours. There's a fascination about Egypt, a glamour, a romance. On my trips, people tell me they've been dreaming of traveling to Egypt since early childhood. There are other wonderful sacred places in the world, Gothic cathedrals, Mayan pyramids, Islamic mosques, Hindu and Buddhist temples. But there is nothing anywhere that matches the grandeur, power, and perfection of Egypt. Yet unless you see Egypt through symbolist eyes, you've not seen Egypt at all. For it is only the symbolist interpretation developed by the brilliant philosopher, mathematician, and alchemist R.A. Shvala de Lubitsch that makes sense of the Egyptian experience. Where establishment academics see only a bizarre, architecturally accomplished but still primitive civilization, Shvala saw and proved that it was based upon a profound and sophisticated sacred science, a science of cosmic principles. One wonders how people come back from Egypt and live lives the way they lived them before, wrote Florence Nightingale back in 1850. The answer is, they don't. 2 weeks in Egypt and you will understand the difference, finally, between true civilization and progress. For detailed information, see my website, jawest.net. Click on Magical Egypt Tours. These are one-of-a-kind trips. There is nothing like them. We find ways to avoid crowds. We meditate in the Great Pyramid. We get into places other people don't get into. The food is great. So are the hotels. The price is remarkably competitive. Just remember, if you don't see Egypt through symbolist eyes, you don't see Egypt at all.
Phoenix Fire!
So, back to our teaching tales. Environmental meltdown, ecological, global warming. I've never been a great believer in signing 1,000 petitions. Does it really do any good to drive a hybrid car? I don't see the military changing over to hybrid tanks. How much can we do individually? My conviction for years, since I've been 19 years old, is that we live in a lunatic asylum, aka the Church of Progress. What can we do personally? Does it matter? My conviction is, and I'll get to this in a future program where we talk about the four cowboys of Apocalypse 2.0, call it pessimism if you will. Again, there's this sense of real futility about doing these little things that in the big picture can have so little effect. Then, not so long ago, a few weeks ago, a story came across my desk, and I forget who it came from, but it's a simple little story. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. And it's about a big storm that hits the East Coast, and the waves wash tens of thousands of starfish up on the shore. Man is walking down the beach, and he sees a young boy methodically picking up the starfish and throwing them back into the water one at a time. And he says to the kid, you know, what are you doing that for? What you're doing is a waste of time. It can't possibly make a difference. The kid doesn't even turn around. He throws another starfish in, and without turning says, made a difference to that one. So there it is. I like that story. Made a difference to that one. So maybe the next car will be a hybrid. I don't know. Anyway, the teaching tales are instructive, and probably all of us have, either consciously or unconsciously, certain teaching tales that guide us at, let's say, sensitive times. My own conviction is that to change one thing in the lunatic asylum, everything has to change. But how to affect that, this is another matter altogether. And then what can we do personally? I'm reminded of a line I remember reading in one of the first of the books that really started the whole rethinking of the horrific situation of the Native Americans, so-called Indians. That was a book back in the 30s, still probably around, very well known in its time. I think I read it back in the 50s, maybe. It's called Black Elk Speaks, about a, I think he was Lakota Sioux, old man, and one of the early ethnographers, anthropologists, was interviewing him, and he wrote a lot of things down. I think Black Elk was actually at Custer's Last Stand, and he talks about a great vision that he had of things changing, but it ended on a downward note because he said, talking about himself, he said, big vision, but small man. So I don't know. Sometimes I have the big vision, but what can I do? Well, I do what I can. Now, back to Boris. Leave our quackademia for the moment and back to Boris and the lawsuit in progress. By this time, we had discovered that he had pillaged about $150,000 out of the till. And when we went through the receipts, eventually it took about a year to get the shoeboxes of receipts from him. And when we went through them, it became clear that a lot of this money had gone to fund various schemes of his own, among them schemes by girlfriends that he was trying to, or would-be girlfriends that he was trying to get into bed. There was a off-Broadway show. There are all kinds of weird things. And mind you, spending money trying to get a girlfriend into bed isn't the worst way to spend money, in my opinion. However, not my money. But nevertheless, the 150 grand was plundered from the till. And actually, to give Boris credit, I know that he didn't intend to steal it. He just figured that we would sell so many videos that the money would come back, and he'd put the money back in before anyone noticed because he knew I wasn't paying attention to where the money was going, and we'd all live happily ever after. But it didn't work out that way. So the lawsuit was in progress, but Boris's lawyers were delaying it endlessly, and meanwhile, I knew that the 200 grand that he got for falling off the toilet bowl had long since gone offshore somewhere, and knowing Boris, probably most of it would have gone to pay for room service in the various hotels that he was staying, or he was cooking up new schemes to con other people. Eventually, we got a judgment, $180,000, the 150 plus the interest, but of course I never knew there'd be anything coming back out of that. However, in my own view, the karma had been worked out and Boris was out of my hair, even though he did make a number of attempts to re-ingratiate himself and get the partnership going again, but I'd been bitten hard, so I was going to have none of that. Now, more stuff comes into play here. All of a sudden, initially, there were two men, the two Joes, Joe Shore and Joe Jehoda, who were members of the Edgar Cayce Foundation, the ARE, Association for Research and Enlightenment. And the ARE were one of the contributors before NBC came on the scene to get our geological research done. And Jehoda was, they were good friends, and both passionate followers of Edgar Cayce's ideas and of his prophecies. And in fact, both of them actually believed they were Atlanteans reincarnated, and they were supposed to find the famous Hall of Records that our seismographs seem to have located, or rather the seismographs located a chamber, what appears to be a chamber, under the left paw of the Sphinx, more or less where Cayce said they would be. And initially, we hoped that Shore, who had very deep pockets, was going to finance the ongoing research that Robert Schock and myself were hoping to do. Of course, unfortunately, we ran afoul of Zahi Hawass at the time, and so there were no more permissions to do the research. And then all of a sudden, through the grapevine, I became aware that Shore, with connections to Florida State University was his alma mater, that University of Florida, with a couple of geologists in tow, were going to do the work that we had hoped to do, and that Shore had basically told us that he would support. All of a sudden, through the grapevine, I became aware that Joe Shore, under the aegis of Florida State University, his alma mater, was launching an expedition to Egypt in order to carry on with the work that we had begun. He had a title, he was a courtesy professor at Florida State. A courtesy professor means absolutely nothing. It means that there is no such title. It means it's an invented title. It means that he put a lot of money into his alma mater, so he was a courtesy professor. However, what it meant in practical terms was that he was trying to steal our work. He wanted to go down in history as the one who found the Hall of Records that Edgar Cayce predicted. In any event, it was clear, became clear, that Boris was behind the whole business, and it was equally clear, knowing Boris's ways, and I'm an astute mathematician, so by adding two and two, I could tell pretty much exactly what had happened, and that was that Boris, who was always pitting one against the other, always, even when we were doing Mystery of the Sphinx, he was telling me what Bill Cody had said about me. Bill Cody's a director. He was telling Bill about things that I had said about him, none of which were true. Actually, Boris was fabricating these things in order to sow dissensions. That's the devil's job. Boris reminded me of a rather burlier Pyotr Stepanovich from Dostoevsky's great novel, The Possessed. Stepanovich, who goes around insinuating and pitting one against the other and so on. So Boris had, let's say, came from a noble lineage. Anyway, Shore was basically trying to steal our stuff. And we had hoped all along, actually, because Shore was on very friendly terms, personal terms, with Sahi Awas, that he would be able to effect a truce between us. But Boris got in the way of that, and suddenly there they were with a major expedition, a big film crew, and a couple of geologists from Florida State in tow. And Boris was supposed to be in charge of the filming and production side of it all. And off they went. Or off they were going to Egypt to look further into the matter, specifically into the geophysics, into finding the Hall of Record. They weren't that much interested in the water weathering side of it, which is actually the most important side. But anyway, I called Shore up and made my dissatisfaction quite clear. And as I recall, he said, "Well, John, somewhere along the line, maybe we can deal you in." And I thanked him profusely for that, and but I warned him. I said, "You know, you're getting yourself involved with Boris, and you're going to regret it." And Shore, "Oh, no. Well, we've got all of this sewed up. There are contracts. Don't you worry. I can take care of Boris." Well, the upshot of it was that the expedition went through. Everybody was under, as I understood it, strict non-disclosure agreements, but of course Boris couldn't keep his mouth shut. So one way or the other, the word again through various grapevines kept trickling back to me that they were spending vast amounts of money, and the big film crew was gobbling up the money day after day and week after week, and they weren't actually finding anything of any consequence, which I must say didn't displease me in the least, though I would certainly like to have the Hall of Records found, but not me blackballed from the process. In any event, the long and short of it was that nothing was accomplished, and then I heard again through the grapevine that Shore, contracts or no contracts, and brilliant businessman that he may have been, was not able to handle Boris, and suddenly he was suing Boris for, I think, $800,000, or it might have been a cool million, but Boris managed to fiddle Shore out of an awful lot of money, and now Shore was taking him to court too, as I understood. I don't know actually what the outcome of that was, but one of the outcomes was that they didn't find anything, and Shore spent a lot of money, and that was the end of the relationship with Joe Shore. The other Joe Jehoda, it was just sort of a good cop, a bad cop, good cop relationship. I have nothing against Joe Jehoda. Periodically we're in touch, and he tells me that Joe Shore is now very ill with Alzheimer's and not out in the open anymore, and I would be a terrible hypocrite if I said I regretted that. Okay, the reincarnated Atlanteans have not come up with the Hall of Records, and meanwhile, the controversy rages on, but now it is agreed, actually. They've given up on wind and sand weathering, and now everybody has agreed that it's water weathering. But it's not water weathering by rain over long periods of time, despite the fact that the geologists at the GSA in 1991 were perfectly happy with rainwater weathering. So now there are a number of alternatives that pop up, ranging from just plain incorrect to genuinely stupid. Unfortunately, the nature of the argument is such that it's very difficult to convey on radio in so many words. It's really a matter of good photographs, or better yet, on-site inspection, to understand why the alternatives just plain can't work. There is a bit of rain on the Giza Plateau, an inch or two every year, And this water does percolate down into the porous limestone, and it also percolates up now with the rising water table, particularly nowadays. It percolates by capillary action up into the limestone, and then on the surface of the Sphinx and the surface of the enclosure, you can see kind of big flakes forming like giant potato chips, and you can see them almost in front of your eyes flaking off and falling to the ground. However, when you look closely, you see that the flakes, they're called laner flakes for reasons that I will get to shortly. The laner flakes follow the already weathered contours. They don't create those contours, and they cannot create those contours. And that, again, is easily demonstrable, but on site, because there are places on that Sphinx enclosure wall where you can see things that have been added, late kingdom tombs that were cut in around 600 BC into the already weathered, deeply weathered bedrock of the enclosure wall. And there you can see just how much damage the laner flakes have done over the course of some 2,600 years, much of which, of course, the Sphinx was covered over with sand, but so was the other enclosure wall, equally covered with sand. And by the way, just the way insight into the way the scholarship and the science is done, it's a peculiar thing, because when we started this off, the enclosure wall, and for this you have to find a good photo, you'll find it on my website, I think, or Shock's website, that you can pull it up if you're interested enough to chase it down. We realized that the Sphinx itself wasn't our exhibit A in the argument. It was the enclosure wall that was the major exhibit, because that had never been repaired, and there the weathering was at its, not only was it at its most extreme, but it was markedly more extreme on the western end, where the water would have come down the plateau and over the back of the enclosure wall, and on the western part of the east-west enclosure wall, where it was prodigiously weathered to the west and barely weathered at all to the east. And this could only be the result of lots of water falling over the wall and creating this enormous amount of weathering. And when I say enormous amount of weathering, it's some on the enclosure wall, the back of the enclosure wall, and the western end of that east-west side, in certain places it's as much as it's 10 or 12 feet. So when we get our geology panel together, when we get our geologist over there, one of the main questions that we will try to address is precisely what kind of conditions would be necessary to create that kind of extreme weathering, and whether or not anybody knows among the attending geologists of an example that parallels what we see on the Sphinx. So this is still to go, but meanwhile, the water weathering is now acknowledged, but the arguments being put forward are really very, very easily shot down in flames. But it's their arena, so when articles are done nowadays, every once in a while a journalist comes along who's willing to listen to both sides, and then we get a fair shake. It was a big article actually on the MSNBC website not too long ago, a few years ago, where somebody really took the time to examine the evidence and pretty much relates it as we say it must have been. And so it goes on, and all sorts of interesting characters come into this debate now. And one of my favorites is a man named an archaeologist actually named Garrett Fagan at Penn State University, who is everybody's favorite Egyptologist. Fagan goes at it hammer and tongs, and if you go to my website, you'll find some very interesting material there on Garrett Fagan. Initially, it begins with an argument that Fagan is having with Graham Hancock, and this develops quickly into a deeply acrimonious debate and an offer to debate this in public at Penn State University. And a date is set for September 29th, 2001. When we return, we will get back to Faganomics, or hoodoo archaeology, as it's called.
Magical Egypt, a symbolist tour in DVD, and more besides. If you can't take a trip to Egypt and experience it firsthand, well, you can't. Not everyone can, but next best and the closest you can get to experiencing Egypt is our 8-episode documentary series, Magical Egypt, a symbolist tour. This is the brainchild of my partner, Chance Gardner, a graphic designer and 3D animator of genius, and this series is an absolutely unique visual, emotional, and intellectual media experience. There are innumerable documentaries about Egypt, dry as dust, misleading, repetitive exercises in Egyptological establishmentarianism from the National Geographic or Discovery Channel or some other wielder of the academic cookie cutter. Pretty pictures, nothing ever that feeds the mind, the heart, to say nothing of the soul. This series fills that gap. We explore Egypt in depth. We follow the ramifications into alchemy, the tarot deck, modern DNA research, sacred geometry, the mysteries of ancient technology. There are interviews with leading-edge scholars, scientists, and thinkers, each contributing to a radical revision of our understanding of the past. For more information, go to www.magicalegypt.com and more. If you've not read my Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, maybe it's time you did. An in-depth introduction to Shwela de Lubitsch's symbolist interpretation. Our Emmy Award-winning classic documentary, Mystery of the Sphinx, now available in an upgraded DVD version. My guidebook, A Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt, an invaluable source of information for armchair and actual travelers to Egypt. I have a few copies of my out-of-print first non-fiction book, The Case for Astrology, left for sale. See my website, www.jawest.net. Click on books.
Phoenix Fire!
So, back to Garrett Fagan, who inspired the name of Quackademia, and Garrett was himself the winner, perennial winner, of the Donald Duck sound-alike contest. To really get a sense of him, you have to see some unadulterated Garrett Fagan in action, and I think you will find that on my website, archived somewhere, where he wrote a absolutely vicious diatribe against Robert Schoch, and I responded in kind. So you might want to access that. In any event, all of this started out with, I think, Fagan provoked it by writing Graham Hancock to tell him that he was using, in his archaeology class, Hancock's book, The Fingerprints of the Gods, as an example of how archaeology should not be done. And Hancock responded, and this grew into many pages, 50 or 60 pages of correspondence going back and forth. And eventually Graham threw down the gauntlet and said, well, let's debate it in public in front of the student body. And Fagan liked that idea. And so all of a sudden, back and forth and to and fro, and a debate was set up in which it would be Robert Bovall, Graham Hancock, myself, and Robert Schoch versus Fagan, I forget, Donald Redford, well-known Egyptologist and by no means the worst of the lot. I was going to debate him on symbolist Egypt. Schoch would debate the geology. I forget with whom. Anyway, it was all set up, and then we became aware of the promotional literature that was going out from Penn State, in which they invited students to witness archaeology versus pseudo-archaeology. Well, this was supposed to be a debate, and debates, it's like starting off a lawsuit by calling the accused the guilty. So we were quite happy to do a debate, but unfortunately, Graham and Robert were furious with this and sort of threatened, I'm not sure if it was an overt or a covert threat, to take a legal action. Anyway, they backed out of the debate. I talked Schoch into not reacting, as conscience declared, but rather to let it go. Anyway, one thing led to another. Fagan claimed that he wasn't responsible for the inflammatory language. Yes, he was innocent, just like OJ. And the whole thing disappeared in acrimony. And as it turned out, out there at Penn State University. This was just as well because the whole thing was scheduled for September 29th, 2001, and the ruins of the Twin Towers were still smoking. There was absolutely nothing else in the news, nor would there be for another 6 months or so. So there have been 11 people at our debate, and the whole thing was abandoned, which was just as well. But it also inspired me in certain other ways. I even invented, when you're dealing with quackademia, a formula for calculating specific duncity, which is obduracy over obtuseness times arrogance squared. And the unit of measure, like volts or ohms or watts, was the Fagan. But anyway, it all disappeared. It all dissolved into nothing. And so the controversy continued. Meanwhile, we were gathering more scientific evidence. The enclosure wall I've talked about. We discovered another thing. One of my friends on one of my trips pointed out a water-weathered little chunk of a monument called the Tomb of Khentkaus, who was one of the queens of Menkaure, the builder of the Third Pyramid, deeply water-weathered behind quite clearly Old Kingdom casing blocks. There were two deep shafts in Saqqara itself, 10 miles to the south, that were deeply water-weathered. There was a chamber in the so-called Red Pyramid that's usually called a plundered tomb chamber, and for years I've been scratching my head about this strange ruined chamber. And on one trip, actually, I was with Doug Kenyon, who's a friend and the editor and publisher of Atlantis Rising magazine, and he was ahead of me as we went into this chamber. You have to get up a set of new wooden stairs to get into a long passageway, and then that leads to this bizarre destroyed chamber, over which is a perfectly preserved corbelled ceiling, similar to what the other two chambers have and what you find above the Grand Gallery of the Great Pyramid. And Doug was ahead of me, and I heard him say, "Wow, look at that. These stones are all weathered. This must have been here first." And then they added the pyramid on top, and I did one of those duh moments, because I've been looking at exactly this thing and for years scratching my head, and it never occurred to me. But once I looked at it, it was absolutely clear that this was a megalithic-looking structure. Looked sort of like the particularly Newgrange in Ireland, I think it is, and quite clearly megalithic in construction, roughly dressed, large blocks, maybe weighing 4, 5, 6, up to 8 tons, piled on top of each other, quite clearly constructed. They were, but these blocks had been out in the weather a long time. It took a while before I could get Shock there to take a look at it, and he concurred, and so over the course of now, what is it, 10 years have elapsed since our original expeditions or our original GSA presentation in San Diego. But now we had a lot more evidence to go. There was the enclosure wall itself. There were West's wells, because I was the one who discovered those. There was Kenyon's cavern. That's the one in the Red Pyramid. And then the corner of the Khentkaus, so-called Tomb of Khentkaus. The friend Jennifer had discovered that. That's Jennifer's Corner. What the hell? If you discover, you're an amateur astronomer and you discover a new comet, it gets named after you. So only fair that the discoverers should have these little bits of evidence. Not little bits, actually. Pretty impressive bits of evidence with their name attached to it. So we now had a whole bunch more evidence. And again, we submitted an abstract to do a second presentation at the Geological Society's annual meeting of 2000. But this one was not in San Diego. It was in Reno, Nevada. When you go to these things, actually, it's like a three-ring circus. There are lots of presentations going on simultaneously in various rooms. You go into most of them, you find 40 people, 50 people, 70 people in a room good for 300, 400, 500. And when it was our turn, the place was full, 500 geologists sitting there listening to an oral presentation. And this was Robert Schock giving it, because he's the one with the letters after his name. But as it turned out, actually, this was not as advantageous. You see, when you sign up for these things, there are poster presentations. That's what we did the first time. That's what they gave us. And there are also the oral presentations, which are just 20 minutes long. Well, you can gather from just what I'm saying here, 20 minutes isn't an awful lot of time to present fairly complicated evidence. And the problem with the oral presentation is that there's almost no question and answer period afterward. So really, nothing came of that other than that it's now down on the track record and we presented our stuff. And apart from the two people who voiced objections, the other 498 or whatever it were basically enthusiastic and came up to Schock afterwards and said, you know, really interesting and blah, blah, blah. Can we help if you do further research and so forth and so on? So that was that particular GSA of 2000. Now, meanwhile, strangely enough, starting in around 99 or maybe it was 2000, there was, through a series of, again, almost miraculous circumstances, I sometimes think the gods have both a sense of humor and are, even so, despite the sense of humor, looking out for us, because there was a rapprochement between Zahi and myself, and this seemed almost inconceivable a few years back. And the way that it came about was very, very strange. For a number of years, I was doing my Egypt trips with a firm that will remain, and a man who will remain nameless, based in Atlanta, that specialized in, let's say, metaphysical travel. And it was always an uneasy relationship. He got people going on the trips all right, but he sold my trips as though they were spiritual snake oil and put out his own brochures and promotional material, which was effectively illiterate. And I cringed, since I'm a writer by trade, to see this stuff going out there promoting my trips. And at a certain point, I broke off the relationship with him. In retaliation, he sent a letter to the Egyptian Tourist Board claiming that I was doing lecturing on site, which is technically actually illegal. And there's a reason for it being illegal, and that is that you have to have a licensed Egyptian guide with you. And this is actually a good rule, because if you didn't have that rule, anybody who'd been to Egypt six times and really didn't know very much would say, the hell with paying an Egyptian guide, I'll do the lecturing myself. But the guides go through quite rigorous training. It's a plum job in Egypt. It's one of those, let's say, middle-class jobs where education is free in Egypt. So anybody who's got the bit of ambition and the interest in becoming a guide can raise himself from, you know, really lower social status to good, solid, middle-class social status. And they have to pass very rigorous tests and a big percentage of failures on it. So it's a good rule because, generally speaking, they know their stuff. Of course, their training is strictly academic, but they know their stuff. But by and large, the way it works is that as long as you have a licensed Egyptian guide with you, they don't really mind if you're doing the talking. Anyway, but this guy put in an official complaint to the Egyptian Tourist Board, and one day I got an email or a phone call from my very good friend Mohammed Nazmi, who's a tour operator called Quest Tours, and he runs my trips for me. He's absolutely a genius operator. We call him the surgeon, actually, because he knows how to operate. And so we get all sorts of special permissions and all kinds of things, get into places where you can't get in normally. Zahi, who's a good personal friend of his, had called him, Mohammed, into his office and showed him this letter that my ex-guy had sent to the tourist board. And Zahi had said, you know, John is not a friend of mine, but I'm not in the tourist business, and I'm not going to act upon this. So Mohammed called me up and said, you know, when you're in Egypt next, which is going to be a couple of weeks later, you should go to Zahi's office and thank him. And I said, you bet I should. So I went in, and as I said, this was a very acrimonious relationship for a long time. And Zahi was saying all sorts of things about us and me in private. I mean, Zahi is very, very public. I'm less so, but I've got a very sharp pen. So I went into his office, and I said to Zahi, you know, hello, Zahi, cool handshake. Mohammed told me about what you did about this particular letter that went through, and I'm here to thank you. And that was very kind of you to do that. You know, we have not enjoyed a very sunny relationship, so it's really much appreciated. And I'd like the war to be over. And he said, well, so would I. You started it. I wasn't about to argue at this point. I said, okay. But let's call it a truce. And can I invite you out for a drink? So I said, okay. And it started off very cool. And then we discovered that we had one interest in common. Zahi hated Boris Said. He loathed him with a passion. And Zahi's a very passionate man. Well, I wasn't about to sort of try to calm the troubled waters. And there was no point really pointing out to him that, in fact, for all the lawsuits and all the plundering and all the rest of it, I owed Boris a big debt. Without Boris, that whole film would never have happened. The theory would have been buried long ago, or it would be confined to a little website somewhere or another. It certainly wouldn't be public, and now it's very public. So I owed Boris a big one, but I wasn't going to mention that to Zahi. So, and over time, it's developed into, I mean, something close to a friendship. In fact, if I'm in Egypt and I don't go see Zahi, and he finds out, he says to Mohammed, "Why John no comes to see me?" And so we go and we have a drink. It's like knights on the battlefield hammering at each other with maces. And then if anybody's still alive, they go back to the tent and have a drink. So all of a sudden, things opened up in terms of the geology panel, which is now the next major stage of the entire enterprise. Zahi has said, basically, without committing himself, and that's okay, I mean, he needs to leave himself some wiggle room, that as long as we get people together with the proper credentials, he will look seriously at what he calls, quote, this very interesting project. So we're very hopeful that if we get the panel together, and strangely enough, not getting the panel together is our fault. The gremlins have been at us, and a couple of attempts to get it together have come to nothing, and now we've got to go back to square one, as it were, and get this panel off the ground, because we feel that we're very confident that once we debate this thing, three of us against three of them, or maybe more, if depending on how it all works out. I should just go back and say that following the GSA presentation in 2000, the argument that then came back at us was, well, all of these geologists who agree with you haven't been to Egypt. And actually, though that sounds like a cop-out, in fact, it isn't, because we could be doing what they do all the time, is ignoring evidence that contradicted our own theory. We haven't, in fact, done that. And in fact, we've answered all of the objections that have been put forward. But fair enough. So the objective is to get three people who, if they're not already convinced of our theory and haven't been to Egypt, are at least open to it. If they have been to Egypt, so much the better. And I should again add in here that over the course of the dozen years or so, a number of geologists went to Egypt to look at the Sphinx weathering and the theory for themselves, and a number of them came back, some of them just privately, but a couple of them publicly, fully credentialed geologists who absolutely agreed that it's water weathering. That concludes our section, Son of Mystery of the Sphinx. Next time, something new and different. Thank you.
Show notes available at www.jawpohenixfire.blogspot.com.
Phoenix Fire!
By Geraint Hughes, www.thepodule.com. More information on John Anthony West is available at www.jawest.net.